nutrient flows are a good way to start this. We generally don't have any trouble with them flowing out, but one of the things we want to talk about is whether those flows might be excessive and what is sustainable. So I have a number of authors on here. I generally present work that my grad students do, and there are a number of them here, so I'm also going to point to some of that work a little later as well. And this is for Darlene Zabowski's benefit. These two people were Stan Gessel and Eugene Steinbrenner. And if you all know me, you know I'm typically focused on producing wood, okay, sustainably. And these two people moved west to Washington and focused on how can we produce forest products sustainably over time. This, by the way, is from the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, something like 1949, or was the most popular magazine in the United States at this time. And it was a sequence of series about heroes of America. And having just come out of World War II and having virtually destroyed a lot of our forest land in the process of taking out material, it was pretty obvious that we could destroy our soils and our productive capacity. So these are people that were working on that. And it's interesting that production foresters could ever be considered as heroes of America, but at least at one time they were. So I want to start as a teacher with a quick quiz here. We'll have answers at the end, hopefully. What are the most productive American forests? And if you want to pick one of these, we've got several options. You can add one. We got pine, southern pine, hybrid poplar, Douglas fir, which is in the Pacific Northwest, or eucalyptus, maybe something like a Euro grandis clone. So we'll get back to that. And what I'm going to talk about now is the idea of the potential for sustainability regarding additional harvest, not just the typical managed forest we have, but additional harvest for biomass. In this particular case, our studies are funded by biofuels. The Northwest Advanced Renewables Alliance, we have two $40 million grants centered out of the state of Washington, one with WSU, one with the University of Washington. And these are aimed at producing aviation fuels from wood or wood residues, okay? And they involve the whole region, the Pacific Northwest being an important forest production region, second only to the South United States and the pines. And what we're talking about here is that this is a typical hemlock stand. Actually, it's a pretty good one. We're typically harvesting this material and maybe taking off the bark as well. In terms of biomass, we're talking about adding this material, okay? And then possibly some of the tops that might be associated with the bole wood here and everything. But the idea is we would probably take off a relatively small amount of additional material that currently remains on the site. Also, defective trees and everything, these would also be removed. So these percentages might be a little bit higher than what they show here. But as you know, we would be taking off a larger or percentage relatively to the biomass of nutrients such as nitrogen. So the question is, can we do this? The concept being something like this. This looks like an awful lot of material, and it is a fair amount of material. Compared to the stems that we're taking off, it's a fairly small amount of material. But we would do something like this. We would take this off and use it to produce biofuels, jet fuels, for instance. And then we would hope that carbon dioxide, photosynthesis, nutrients, and water, and so on, would replace that material for the next harvest. So if this is indeed what happens, we can do this sustainably, and that's the goal. Okay, that material wouldn't probably come for our normal stems. These are highly valuable. The most valuable wood produced in any large amount is Douglas fir, okay, used for structural purposes. It would be this kind of material. So we would be coming back. Currently, a lot of this material is actually piled and burnt because there's so much of it, it's a problem for regeneration. So it's not necessarily left on site intact as it is. some cases the ashes would be left on site. The model we're using, and this is a crude one, and I don't promise that it answers everything about sustainability, but it's a workable model. Comes out of, for instance, Dale Johnson's analysis, and the idea being that we would have a risk rating. A low risk rating would be if we took 0.1 or 10% or less of the total ecosystem pool of nutrients. A serious problem might occur if we started to take 30% or more, and we would expect to create a big problem if we start taking off half of the ecosystem nutrient pools, for instance, nitrogen. And in the case of an analysis at the Fall River ecosystem, if we took off all that material, including the tops and any slash remaining and all the foliage, we'd remove about 9%, a 0.09 rating in terms of nitrogen. So this would say that at least for Fall River, we are not seriously an immediate sustainability problem. Doesn't answer all the questions, but it is a way to work. And in fact, we did this for a number of sites. If we consider, this is a paper that was published regarding this particular study, where we have a number of sites up and down the west of the coastal part of the United States, northern Vancouver Island to southern Oregon, not quite penetrating into California, but what we call the coastal Douglas fir production region. And there's a variety of different geological of parent material origins, including glacial, sedimentary toward the coast, and then igneous parent materials. There's a crude cut of these. There's a lot of variability within these as well. And here's our evaluation of the sustainability of these particular sites, ranging from northern Vancouver Island to southern Oregon. And what we have here is we have the removal in terms of kilograms per hectare of nitrogen with a full rotation. So in some cases, if these stands weren't yet at harvesting age, we grew them in a growth model until they were. And then we have the site in stores, quite variable, down from a few hundred kilograms up to 20,000, 25,000 kilograms in the top meter of soil, which is a pretty big pool of nitrogen. And in the case of the stem-only harvest, we would be doing, this would be the open figures. And right of this line, we would have a stability ratio of less than 0.1. So we would, with this way of evaluating, we would say this was relatively safe. In between this sort of this blue 0.1 to 0.3, we would start to have some concern about it. Of course, we could always add that nutrient if necessary. And then above 0.3, we'd have a pretty significant concern. Okay. Then with the whole tree harvest, we would just about double that removal, and we would shift a lot more of these that are here into a concern area. All right, so this is a quick way to evaluate a region. It's a tool. It's nothing more than a tool to try and get a first glimpse at sustainability. And in general, it looks pretty good for business as usual, and it looks like there might be a little more concern for intensive biomass removal. Now, we are very interested in all the potential sources of nutrients for these, so we've actually taken these same sites, and this is the paper that was produced, and we've tried to extend this into basically management throughout the region. The big conclusion we come from this, if you think about a simple nutrient like nitrogen ranging from a few hundred to 25,000 or so kilograms, is the impacts are likely to be very site-dependent. I wish it were a more useful conclusion, but what it's saying is you do have to have site information in terms of evaluating this sustainability. So we're looking further into this. One of the authors is here. If you're interested, there'll be a talk a little bit later about deeper soil carbon. So we've had an interest. We've noticed that many of our soils continue to have carbon and nutrients deeper into the profile. So there's some work done, not easy work at all, and not necessarily easy on all, capable on all sites, for instance, very steep sites. So this is a limited subsample of those of that broader regional study through the region. And you can see here the depth to which we're now sampling. OSHA probably wouldn't approve of this particular. A follow-up study, we did brace the sites later on. But we're talking about a maximum depth of about 3.5 to 4 meters. So if we look at soils, this is one particular soil, okay, surface down into the deeper soil profile. We tend to have carbon, at least as evidenced by the color. And if we plot carbon, we can see that there's a substantial amount of material deeper in. And by the way, Christiana Dyson is going to have a poster about this kind of thing for the Fall River study. I think it's later on in the conference. It's poster number 1927 if you're interested. But more importantly, nitrogen follows a similar profile. The question is whether or not this nitrogen deeper than a meter, which can be substantial, could also be used. If we can actually start to use this deeper soil material, we start to change our picture of air stability ratio for the better, and pushing it into a higher total site in pool. And these are a few where I've applied that. So the conclusion here in terms of deeper soils is, yeah, there is a lot of carbon and nitrogen and other things possibly down into that soil profile. But is this important? And in order to be important, maybe do the roots go there? So we did a little evaluation. This, if we think about the importance of deeper soils, I go back to the person that was kneeling in that original picture, Eugene Steinbrenner, and he did this evaluation of effective soil depth versus site index, which is a measure of productivity, of course. And he found a very direct but variable relationship between productivity and soil depth. And if you know why he cut everything off at about 5 feet, anybody who's ever dug a hole deeper than 5 feet, you know. Oh, I thought you were signaling my time, Luke. Yeah. Well, if you don't have rocks, you can use a bucket auger, but many of our soils are rocky. So this is about as deep as graduate students are willing to dig before you tend to start losing them. They tend to start quitting on you. In terms of evaluating roots within that, now this would be this is a single sample, so this would be a minimum rooting depth. We don't know, we didn't do a root dynamic study or anything like that. But for the sites that we did the deep, this is down to 350 centimeters or so, we did find roots almost always down to about a meter and sometimes considerably deeper. Okay, so if the presence of roots is an indicator, they might be exploiting some of the soil nitrogen down deeper. Now all these zeros are where we actually took soil samples, but we didn't find roots, okay, at least when we sampled them. That doesn't mean that they might not be in another place, another time, or a different part of the season. So we're now trying to study where we can in rock-free soils using an auger and an impact core method as deep as 3 meters. And this is some sampling that's done at the Fall River long-term soil productivity study, and Christiana is going to talk about this a little bit later. The idea being if we could have, this is kind of the current picture we often have of forest productivity. We know soil's important, but we don't tend to study very much of the soil. When the forest inventory and analysis was criticized for not studying soil, for instance, a long time ago, they did add studies of soil, but just superficially, only to 20 centimeters. So I'm not saying that it's easy. But if you turned it around and you said, okay, I'm going to study the top meter of trees, and I'm going to study all the soil, and then you're going to say, that's my forest ecosystem, what would tree people, what would above ground people do? They would scream bloody murder. Soil scientists kind of take it, you know. Of course, this is the real system, and we are all preaching to the choir, as Helga said here, but it doesn't make it any less correct. It is very difficult, we know, to study soil. And I wanted to talk a little bit about other nutrients, and we are following up on this, but the idea of a nutrient like calcium, which is also part of the symposium. So we took this same set of sites, and where we sampled deeply, we developed tried to develop a relationship between exchangeable calcium, in this case, and total nitrogen in the top 100 centimeters of soil. And there seems to be a bit of a relationship, with the idea of higher nitrogen is almost always higher productivity, more removals, also that higher amount of nitrogen, for it to get down into the profile somehow, it has to move. And these anions, when they move, they carry cations with them, and mostly they carry calcium. So the idea that high nitrogen can deplete soil calcium, we're going to hear a lot about that, I hope, in our next talk. Okay, so you see, there does seem to be a relationship here. Our highest level, with one exception, there's always that student or that soil sample that doesn't behave. But we have very high exchangeable calcium here, very high, actually, and then down to very lower levels with higher total nitrogen. This follows a model of calcium depletion very nicely, calcium leaching and depletion. However, if we extend that deeper into the soil profile, now keep in mind this is exchangeable calcium, this is not total calcium. If those plants can start to utilize some of that calcium deeper in, by the way, this also follows very nicely with the model that very high productivity, very high flux, very high nitrogen ecosystems can weather that out and push it down into lower regions where it then becomes absorbed or this must be absorbed because it was exchanged. That's how we measured it. And then many of their soil samples seem to show very low levels of calcium, but this is a cumulative calcium. As we go deeper into the soil, in some cases very deep, we start to see it increase. So one of the questions for a model where we would worry about the depletion of cations in the surface would be, can trees somehow tap into this? For instance, these very low levels, could trees, at least their quick analysis of roots seem to say they don't have roots there, they might not be able to use this, but it is there. So, for conclusions, so again, I'm afraid that we're very site dependent. We can move a couple meters and get completely different results. It is very much about soil, and if soil is about parent materials, it also is about parent materials in geology. The other thing, presence, which is what we're measuring here, is not the same as availability. I don't pretend to be able to say that all that nitrogen, all the calcium would be available. These are complicated relationships. Oh, by the way, the question, okay, what was the most productive American forest? Did everybody come up with an answer?
Where are your units?
Now you start to pick apart my teaching method. So I just want to show of hands. How many say southern pines are the most productive forest in America? Just most productive. High red poplar. Nobody's going to answer. I'll just. Okay. Pacific Northwest Douglas fir. Okay. We've got our north. Even Tom knows that. Okay. How about eucalyptus? Maybe a clone of Euro and Grandis.
If done well.
Yeah. Yeah. We have the Hawaii people. I sort of left Hawaii out, but the fact is, all your answers are correct, depending on your point of view. And this is sort of my point about nutrient budgets, calculating these things versus what's available to trees. We have a lot of acres of southern pine. It's not as productive as Douglas fir, conifers, per acre per year, but there's a lot more acres. Hybrid poplar. For something that has any amount is quite productive, but tens of thousands of acres don't equal millions of acres of pine and Douglas fir forest. Doug fir is a little bit more productive on the average than southern pines, but they're catching up really fast. And then also, South America is also America, right? So thank you all. And I think I have a little time for questions.
Whether it is necessary for roots to be present for nutrients to be available. Other mechanisms for what's down there to get up here.
Yes, and in fact, that was what I was hoping. We seeded that question, so just to get started. So, we have capillary rise, and in the Pacific Northwest, we have a dry summer. So typically, we see water moving up, and whether that's redistributed with roots, when they're present, that also probably happens as well. So there is the potential for some rise, but I don't know exactly how much. I think it depends an awful lot on continuous capillaries and soil physical properties.
You're right. As a master's student at Wisconsin, a few years ago, for my thesis, one of the things I did was measure capillary rise and phosphorus. And it occurs, and it goes quite a ways.
How many meters? Did you?
Well, the groundwater was about 2 meters down, and the capillary rise went up about 25% of that.
Yeah.
So
it's substantial. Yeah, and I've seen capillary rise above a hole in the ground of a meter, and just under just the right conditions, where the water wet that high. So
it's plain field sands, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably higher in most soils that have better physical properties. And another point is that rooting is, that's one sample. So, it's a minimum. The roots were there, so probably the rooting depth on the average is a little deeper, too. Absolutely, it's a minimum rooting depth, and that's temporal and spatial. Darlene. No, that was a sample that was taken, and then picked apart for roots being present in the sample. Well, I did have a slide from Stone, and I'm surprised Richter isn't asking me a question about rooting depth, but roots can extend many, many meters into soil.
And
so,
I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we often think of the weird coarse roots of going down really deep, but we've seen fine roots actually at least a couple of meters down in our soil as well, too, and more.
Well, I'm seeing roots a couple meters too, Darlene, so that's not unusual. Right.
I'm going to hold additional questions perhaps for the discussion, and thank you, Rob.
Thank you.